Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. Many atheists find themselves trapped with a secret life. In this third part of a series of podcasts, Discovery Institute fellow Paul Nelson interviews Rabbi Moshe Averick on the new atheist search for meaning in a meaningless world, and a better way forward to find truth through open debate.
Part 3 of the book, it's chapters 6 and 7, talks about man's search for meaning and spirituality. What do you see as the three fundamental issues here, or maybe just one of them you could elaborate on, depending on what you find most relevant?
Well, the section about man's search for meaning is that, and its relationship to atheism, I would say that one of the little subsections really sort of sums it up. There's a little subsection called The Secret Life of Atheists Seeking Meaning in a Meaningless World. On the one hand, you will have, and this is, Richard Dawkins will make a statement to the effect that the world that we live in has no design, no purpose, no good, no evil. He says nothing but pitiless indifference. And then the next sentence he says, what a noble and enlightened thing to do, to study the world, to study. What do you mean? It's no purpose, there's no purpose, there's no design, but it's so noble and enlightened to study the. Like, what is he talking about? This is one of the examples of the atheist disconnect. In other words, this a guy who essentially, you will have Sigmund Freud, who writes that the moment a man contemplates the meaning and value of life, he is sick, since objectively neither has any existence. Now, you can't get any more, I mean, talk about causing depression. I mean, that'll send the guy to a psychiatrist right there, right? So, and then there's no, objectively, there's no meaning to life, and there's no value to life. So why did he spend his whole life writing about books and writing about people and there's no value to people, but I'm going to write books about it my whole life? This is the absurdity. And,
you know, it's funny. He said in his therapy that his goal was to enable people to be able to love and to work.
Right.
Get up in the morning, have a meaningful existence in terms of what they did with their life, right, and to love those around them. Now, that, to me, is noble and inspiring.
Right.
On the other hand, if the world is as Freud thought it was, that's going to be a very tall order.
It sure is. To hold those two ideas together is obviously impossible. You can't do it. So what you do is you create, and this is a great phrase that Dr. Julian Baggini, he's another atheist writer. He's not so militant, by the way. He's a British philosopher. I actually was in touch with him a little bit. He's very dispassionate. I disagree with everything he writes. But he is not one of these like wild, raving and ranting guys like, say, Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens. And he talks about creating comforting fictions. He talks about religious people creating comforting fictions, but I sort of stole his phrase. And I said, what the atheist does is creates comforting fictions for himself. Richard Dawkins says the whole world is nothing but pitiless indifference. It has no purpose. It has no design. And then in a moment later, he will spend his whole life, devote his whole life to understanding the world, a world that has no purpose and no design and has nothing meaningful in it. But somehow he finds meaning in it. And this is like the circle that all these guys go around and over and over again. And ultimately, what it shows is that we are hardwired. We need meaning. We can't live without it. A person who actually lives faces this right without any, without any ifs, ands, or buts. There is no meaning. There's no purpose. Either he has to create a comforting fiction, or he'll jump off the nearest available building. That's what he'll do. There is no way a human being can survive that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the essential point of that chapter. In terms of some of the other stuff we talk about, consciousness, spirituality, this is another thing, that the idea of consciousness, which I never really looked into. And the more I looked into it, I realized that the only thing that I can say is there's a certain arrogance, unfortunately, that has permeated some of the scientific world. They talk as if they understand all these things. And in fact, the most important things about being human, right, which is number one, how did life begin all things? Where did we come from? Nobody knows.
How are we aware of ourselves?
Yeah, why are we aware of ourselves? Nobody really has any idea. But we're working on it. In 50 years, we're going to, you know, Lawrence Krauss, I saw a video of him at the, he says, oh, I know in 10 years we're going to have machines that are conscious, that are thinking about themselves, that are aware of them. I mean, you know, I think Sidney Alman looked at him, was trying to hold himself back. He says, what are you talking? I mean, he asked him, he says, could you tell us, you think there's going to be machines that are conscious? Anyway, he was holding himself back. But, you know, it's a wild statement. And he's a scientist. And he's brilliant. So, well, must be. We're going to have machines that are conscious. And the fact is, of course, nobody has a clue how we're conscious. And this is across the board. And, you know, like Sir Roger Penrose wrote a whole book on it, no idea. I was even shocked to see George Wald weigh in, who said some wacky statements about evolution that he had to retract later on. But and he said that the problem is, of course, is that science lies within consciousness. It's not the consciousness. He says you have to be conscious to look at science first. Then what do you mean that we're going to solve it? You know,
it looks to me like there's a parallel here with the problem of the origin of life and this sense of having to nail it all down to a physical explanation.
Right. Exactly.
In other words, if consciousness, let's say, is irreducible.
Right.
In other words, it's part of what you have as a human being. You're mm-hmm. built with it.
Right.
But it does not dissolve into lower level entities. What that implies then is an incompleteness of the materialistic understanding of reality.
Right, exactly.
Ergo, if you take the materialistic understanding of reality as a given, consciousness has to be dissolved whether in fact you can do it or not. In other words, you're given this problem to solve not by the evidence,
right,
but rather by a philosophical a priori that tells you this is the way the world has to be.
And an article of faith, in other words.
In other words, yeah. Do you think that's healthy for science?
Oh, well, what could be unhealthier? This is the irony. You have scientists who say, well, and I've had this discussion. I've had a brilliant scientist say to me, well, why are you demanding that level of evidence from me? You demand, my God, you're a scientist. Isn't that what you're supposed to be operating? You have to have evidence for what you're putting forth. He says, no, we scientists have done so much, you should just trust that we'll find an answer. I mean, that's science speaking? That is not science, you know what I'm saying? And,
yeah.
And that can only be extremely unhealthy for science and extremely unhealthy for anybody to operate that way.
Well, one of the problems, I think, is that perhaps since the middle of the 19th century, there's been an identification of the scientific enterprise, which I take at its base to be empirical. You take testing as your foundation. The claims you make must be supported by evidence. They must be vulnerable to challenge.
Right.
Evidence should arise. That enterprise, which has generated so much for humanity,
right,
you know, enabled us to have some control over our world and so forth, and to learn a great deal.
Right.
That enterprise has come to be identified with naturalism or materialism. And
right.
The two are very different. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think that what I don't understand is why those two got mixed up. Why should they get mixed up? And I think it has to do with maybe the sort of the darker side of human nature, which is nobody like, and Christopher Hitchens says it explicitly. He goes, why would I want to live in a celestial North Korea where I've got this thing watching? That's one of his favorite phrases. And then, of course, I point out the book is one of the Atheist Disconnect. Mr. Hitchens, North Korea, the worst, the most horrible, officially atheistic country. You know, like, that's your example of the most horrible place under atheistic country. Like, can you pick something else? Like, anyway, but so what I was saying is that there is, I think, a part of all of us. Nobody likes to be told what to do. I mean, let's face it. Nobody likes it. And, I still believe in God. You believe in God. You know, and there's times, there's no question at all. I was like, could you just leave me alone a little bit? You know, like, that is, it's annoying. So I think that there is a, that's part of it. And somehow it's become, whoever has this propaganda has come from, that in order to be rational, you have to not believe in God. I don't know the history of it. You probably know more about that than I do. From the
philosophy
of science,
I think,
and how science develops and how these ideas get into science. But that's what I see as a rabbi. This is an age-old problem. You know, I don't want somebody telling me what to do. I like to feel that I'm the one in charge, that I'm number one, I'm on top. And I see at its root, that's where it's coming from. Now, the history of it, how exactly, you know, it transformed from where scientists, a guy like Gregor Mendel, who was a great scientist, I mean, a very important scientist, and he was a monk, he believed in God, certainly, he believed he was discovering God's creation, how that transformed into, if you believe, if you're religious, then, you know, we fire you from your job at NASA, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a crazy thing, and this is one of the reasons I think that scientists, of all people, should know a little bit about the history of their own discipline. Get back prior to the 19th century, or the middle of the 19th century, let's say, and look at the development of physics, of biology, of the major disciplines of the natural sciences prior to the assumption of naturalism, and ask the question, was knowledge being generated by someone like Linnaeus? Kepler, Newton, Boyle, Galileo, and so forth. Because there's a parochial, in the bad sense, vision of science that says it's only healthy when it begins with an atheistic metaphysic.
Right.
And simply it's a descriptive matter that's historically bunk.
Right.
And I think it would be good for scientists to know that. It would be good, frankly, for atheists to know that. I think one of the reasons people find them so off-putting in many cases is they don't know the history of their own debate.
There is a concept within Jewish thought that every lie has to have some truth to it, or else it will not be able to stand. If I would say what is the truth, I would kind of paraphrase this something by Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell said that I hope all religious belief will die out. I don't remember the exact quote, but I am prepared to admit that it's had some good effects at different times. Okay, so I sort of turn it around. I would say I hope all atheism, skepticism dies out. However, I will admit that at times it has had some good positive effects. I think that the truth in the view of guys like this is that there certainly have been people who have gotten so fanatically zealous about their religious beliefs where it has caused horrible things have happened. And so if skepticism has done anything good, what it has done is that it has forced, sort of cut off maybe that really horrible edge of zealousness where you're prepared to trample on anyone who gets in your way. Unfortunately, like for instance, we see in the radicalization of the Muslim world, they could use some good skepticism. How do you really know that flying an airplane into a building is going to get you to paradise? How do you really know that?
So,
we talk about how you know that that's true? Where did you get that? Because your father told. So that has been the positive effect of skepticism. But that's it. Good. So now I think we agree. We have to. I think the model of American democracy is where in your own home believe whatever you want. And this is one of the things that I say to skeptics is that look. The system, the reason why American democracy works, I don't know if it's going to continue working, we'll see. But the reason why it has worked so far is that the founding fathers said, look, in your own home, serve God any way you want. In the public and the way we're going to make laws, we're going to make laws based on the fact that every human being is created in the image of God and you have inherent rights from God. And there is no way to get rid of those. In your own home, you want to believe that there's no God, that you're a bacteria, that's fine. But when you live in the public, you're going to act as if every human being has been created in the image of God and has inherent rights. In your mind, believe whatever you want.
That's right.
And that is so far it seems to have worked. Now, obviously, I believe that the founding fathers were guided by God to set up this system. And it to a certain extent, it works better than a lot of other systems,
Yeah.
So that I'm prepared, absolutely. I'm not prepared to put atheists in jail for their beliefs. Say anything you want. But you have to start thinking straight.
Let me ask you a little bit more about this model for a healthy public discussion.
Right.
One of the models that I like is ancient Greek dialectic, where it's proposition, counterproposition, and what you have is a debate in which truth is reached at or is achieved dialectically through struggling to understand.
Right.
An open discussion where everyone who doesn't dominate or shout, is welcome to join in. There's a model that I learned as a youngster from going to Jewish nursery schools and being around yeshivas and so forth, and that is the debate that happens in rabbinic study.
Right.
There's something inherently good about debate, about having a proposition that's up for challenge,
right?
And do you see that as a good model?
I couldn't agree with you more. As a matter of fact, just to take it a step further, in the yeshiva system, which is the rabbinical Talmudic academies, there's the essential most of the time study is you never study by yourself. You always have a study partner. It's always two. You'll go into some of the large yeshivas where there's hundreds of students, and you'll see rows and rows of people where you have partners sitting next to each other screaming at each other. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And the in fact the sages say that the person who learns by himself isn't going to be in big trouble because his mind doesn't get sharp. He's going to make mistakes. In fact, the metaphor that's always used throughout the Talmud is that the great scholars are called in Hebrew Balei Trisim, which means shield bearers. It's the the metaphor of the warrior, of the intellectual war. And that's how you come to the truth, by fighting, by challenging, back and forth. And unfortunately, I mean, I don't have to tell you, as part of the discovery incident, what's happening now, of course, is that they are, you know, there's an attempt to squash anybody, you know, and with any means possible, who, you know, who sort of disagrees with this standard, you know, materialistic view of science.
Well, I have to tell you, in all candor, one of the things that's most frightening to me about the new atheism is their unwillingness to address what has happened in our own lifetimes, or certainly over the past century, in those cultures where atheism has held political power.
Right.
It has not been tolerant of dissent. It has not been tolerant of debate. Try finding a Bible, let's say, in Stalinist Russia.
Right.
Try finding some of the great works of literature in Stalinist Russia. They were not available.
Right.
So I do not think the track record of free speech, of intellectual freedom, call it what you want, is very distinguished. I mean, you mentioned North Korea a moment ago.
Right.
No one, not Hitchens, not Harris, not Dawkins, would want to live in North Korea for 2 days. You know, it's kind of a vision of hell on earth.
Right.
So I think there's a kind of bracing reality there that needs to be addressed.
Right.
And I would encourage the new atheists to take as their model this model of debate, of free and open exchange of views, of discussion.
Right.
Because my own conception of truth is that I like to personify her. She exists independently of us.
Right.
She's out there in terms of science, philosophy, mathematics. Truth is independent of us. She will not be caged. And she honors those, I guess you could say, who honor her. And she can be reached through open discussion and dialogue.
Right.
I think the great strength of science is because the world is independent of us and has its own regularities and so forth, that we can discover our own frail, stumbling ways to discover. We can lean on truth and she'll reward us.
Right.
But to do that, we need to have the freedom to debate.
No, exactly.
That was Discovery Institute fellow Paul Nelson interviewing Rabbi Moshe Averick, author of Nonsense of a High Order, The Confused and Illusory World of the Atheist. Stay tuned for part 4. For ID the Future, I'm Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.